Please help me welcome Rick.
Good evening, my name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Michael, and thank you, Lee, for asking me to come on up here a while back. And my sobriety date is February 18th, 1987. I have a sponsor, actually, who I drug along here with me, and he brought his wife. And this is my mom. That's my companion, David. I'll tell you more about that later. But anyway, we had just had Italian food, and so if you see him fall asleep, it's not a big deal. They're here to support me. And it was a great ride up here. I haven't been to Santa Maria in over 30 years. And obviously, because of the tragedies that took place along the coast, we took the 166, which I had never taken before. A beautiful, beautiful drive. I get the willies if I don't see buildings after maybe every 5 miles. I am horrified to think we are driving down that dark black road where I've seen every single murder committed on murder mysteries on TV. We will not stop if a big truck is in trouble. I won't care if somebody jumps in front of us. They're gone. They're dead. So it's weird, you know, and but it was a beautiful coming up here. Single mom, Hispanic family. So single mom meant we were with our grandmother also. My mom lived with my grandmother. And my mom worked at a pharmacy. She was well into pharmaceuticals. And that's her story. But just take it, the reality is she's a wonderful woman who I've grown to know and love. But as a child, my mom would start cleaning at 11:30 at night and not get to bed till 4 in the morning. And she had an apron full of pills. And from there, which, you know, the next significant, she remarried, and she remarried Texans. Raise your hand if you're from Texas. Oh, well, good. Anyway, she married a alcoholic, rageaholic, racist Texan. And I'd never been exposed to anything like that. And but that was her choice. And I was just a preteen. And that was pretty horrifying in itself. Growing up, you've heard too many, I mean, all of us say pretty much the same thing. I felt odd. I felt a little bit different. I didn't fit in. I didn't feel comfortable in my skin. Okay, and I think that that's actually part of the angst of growing up. But I did fit in those things. When I was, many of you won't remember this, but when I was 11, for instance, I ordered, there was a thing through Capitol Records, ordered 12 records, 11 are free, you pay for one. And it was like one penny or something. Anyway, even at that young age, I was beginning to maneuver and, you know, manipulate the system. So I did it. And what did I order? What did I order? I ordered Funny Girl, Cabaret, Man of La Mancha, 3 Barbra Streisand albums, and some other musical theater. Okay, so I didn't hear you really giggling too much, so I don't know if you don't feel free or what, but basically, I had been given the homo card, and I didn't know it. I was 11 years old. This was, this was many years ago. This is over 40 years ago. Actually, it was over 60 years ago. Life was very, very different. And there wasn't the consciousness there is today. And I was 11 years old. How would I have even known? You know. So anyway, life went on. The next, in terms of that, and this has nothing to do with gay or not gay, but when I was 13, I discovered there were seamstresses in my family that had been very successful. And I, one afternoon, cut up a sheet, and I couldn't read the pattern, but I could sew, and I put this thing together. Like guys take to working on cars or with wood or metal. That's what I could do. And the thing is that I didn't know why, but I knew in my gut it was wrong. And so right from the get-go, I swore my sister to secrecy, and I bargained with her and made her promise that she would take credit for whatever got done. And that continued actually till I was 19 years old. And when I finally, you know, was able to be honest, it was just a lot of shame related to, and I really didn't know why. I just knew it wasn't, again, it was not the time of designers, you know, the whole thing that has taken shape in the our world today. You know, I didn't know someday I'd be almost 64 years old wearing all my bling on one hand so I can just like smack somebody really good. I didn't know that would ever be allowed. But so college, oh, one other little thing. That stepfather, Bernie, this will sum him up. When they were senior getting a ride to school, and there on the garage, interior of the garage door, he printed, "Rick is a fag, he should die." And what was very interesting about that recollection I have is that my mom got quiet, my sister didn't say anything, and my mom said, "Hurry up, we're going to be late." That was it. It was also a time, and I don't know if we would process it anyway, because we had the typical dysfunction in our family. But things like that, when there wasn't anything said, I figured it was my fault. You know, and as horrifying as that was, you know, so all that kind of stuff went inside me. College, and I went away to college. I went to a private college, and it was there. I had not had any drinks prior to that time. I didn't want to be like Bernie. And there I am in college, and I suddenly discover wine. Again, I'm not going to go into detail. It started with wine. I discovered I liked bars. I loved going to a bar and calling out a Manhattan or whatever, martini, and learning the different types of liquor. I loved being able to be at a bar for last call. And when the lights would come on and you were still there and you were still basically standing or could maintain, that to me made me feel like I was coming of age, like I was becoming a man. And I liked that. And so I became a bar drinker. And however, I studied, I got my degree, I got my bachelor's, I went on to get a master's in theology and a master's in divinity. So, but I was a daily drinker by the time I had done all that graduations. And assigned to my first job, nonprofit, and I took off. So the deal is that I had been studying in a Roman Catholic seminary, and so I was ordained a Roman Catholic priest. So here comes Father Rick, and I was young, new, I didn't know what the heck was going to happen. And again, let me just put a disclaimer here. If, you know, please know this, I have tremendous respect for the men and women who are part of the Catholic faith today, the men and women who work within the Catholic faith today. So if anything I say sounds offensive, that's because Rick was offensive. I really was, and I had no idea. That's the track alcohol took me on. I was a young man. Here I am, and it seemed like every assignment I was given, you know, as a young guy, you take this mass. They gave me this know-nothing mass. It was 5:30 in the afternoon. Well, in 2 years, and there was like 20 people there. Most of them were the homeless. And so that was my kind of like punishment. Okay, you're young. You have to work your way up. Well, within a year, what Rick did was two things. I accidentally began to meet other people my age who were young who wanted to be a part of the church. And I just asked them for help. And I ended up getting help. And then I also, at the same time, remember that drinking thing? I was continuing to drink. I found a couple of bars. I was in the West Side in a very large, wealthy parish. And I continued to drink, made friends. And I would do, what would you find Father Rick doing on a Saturday night? Well, it's about 7:15. I would have been getting ready to go hear confessions. I'd already had my afternoon drinks. I'd had a glass of wine that was appropriate at dinner, so they only see me drinking one glass of wine. Now I'm going to head off to confessions. I hear confessions, hope to goodness I can get out by 9 o'clock, shut that door, jam down to the bar maybe, or more likely, I would go to the bar for a couple hours, Then I would hit the club because Father Rick liked to dance, and I would drink and blah, blah, blah. So there I am. So the thing is that I'm not making this up. I would then meet people like the following day. I remember this one time when it almost spooked me because it was this big tall guy, and he was just like, "Were you dancing last night at the club?" And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, "I can't believe it. Oh my gosh, that's why I need to come back to the church." I'm like, oh my God. All I did was drink and dance, and I'm bringing people back to God. And I was just like, oh, thank you, Lord. I have found my path. I have really found my path. And so, you know, there was a lot of, "Father Rick, you're so normal. Father Rick, we really like you." What that translated into, "Thank you, Father Rick, for letting us do our lines of coke outside the restaurant in the parking lot and come back to the table and drink with you," because I knew what they were doing, but I didn't want to do it. That wasn't my thing. I let them do their thing. They came back. They let me do my thing. You know what? That's how it worked. Anyway, bottom line, gained a lot of popularity. The mass very quickly ended up being standing room only, like 12 to 1,500 people. That's amazing. Now, here's the thing. It's not to give me a pat on the back, even though I'm fabulous. It's because what's significant here is that the church, like any institution, it can't run like our institution. We have to collect money. There are costs, and there are costs within every single church. And so suddenly, I was bringing home the bacon, big time. I had this, developed this whole liturgy, and it was a whole new set of folks who had money to spend, and dollars were coming into the church, and they were really happy, so they gave me a lot of leash. Now, they didn't give me a raise. I made $225 a month. That was it. So, but that mass at 5:30, they didn't count the money. The money counters had already left. They put it in the file cabinet, two drawers. Well, it was a really old cabinet, so if you kicked the bottom drawer, it opened up, and I started, they were just like muslin bags with cash, no locks on them. So I started to take out handfuls of cash. So it'd be, a few hundred dollars at a time. Didn't even seem like you were making a dent. Well, I did that for 7 years straight. And there were other times when I was able to take even big money, larger amounts, which, that makes me laugh. I used to complain about people. I'd say, "Please, can you come bless my car?" And they'd say, "Here's $100. And I'd be like, "Sure, do you have any more cars you need blessed?" That may not seem right, but my mind was, I need the cash so I can share it with my friends. At that point, I still liked drinking with people. It made me feel not like a drunk. I enjoyed, and I have no problem paying for whoever if I could share. As things escalated, I gained popularity. Things were working out for me. I had that youthful, that thing that happens in our late 20s when things click. I had that going for me. But at the same time, my alcoholism was running right next to me. And I didn't see it. I can now. That's one of the gifts of this program. But for instance, I didn't think it was a big deal. People would regularly say, "Will you come join us for dinner this Friday, whatever, this night? We're going to invite some people over." Sure. And I would plan on going. And then I'd get distracted, have a drink. Once I had some drinks, I was like, let me have another couple drinks, and then I'll go. Oops, it's too late. And then the lies had to start. Why couldn't I get there? Why? And people, I didn't get it. People would tell me, they'd say, she's really disappointed, they're really mad. And I would hear that, and I would squeeze my way through it, and apologize. But honestly, I didn't feel it. I had no compassion in that area because I was self-centered. I was consumed with what I needed. I just didn't see how it was a bad thing. So here I am, and you see how I'm progressing. I'm the priest that steals on a regular basis, that lies and disappoints his parishioners. At the same time, I'm successful in certain superficial arenas. I'm a good dancer. And then I began to skip classes, courses I was teaching. I'd always team up with somebody. And so that's what how things continued to go on. As things progressed, I needed, I kind of quit liking to be in the bars I knew. And I sought out seedier places. I needed to find lower companions. And that's what I did. And I liked going to really seedy, nasty bars. The nastier, the better. And there were a couple of peers that were just, you know, they told people not to even go to them. And I liked them. I liked the drunks there. Nobody gave me a hassle. It was a time when I began to, when I was drinking, I'd find myself in, I was going to say awkward circumstances. They weren't that awkward. But they were, I don't know if any of you have, when you were drinking or drunk or high or whatever, found yourself in a very quick relationship. That can be mildly amusing, but it doesn't really even matter if it's amusing. You know, men work mechanically, like, okay, that feels good, let's do it, boom. And then, okay, bye, see ya. And that's what began to happen. I could not, I was a diocesan priest. I had taken a vow of celibacy. So it's not like I could go back to the parish or the next morning and go, you know, Monsignor, I feel like trash. Did you ever wake up next to somebody you didn't know? Like, no, that would not happen. And so these were things I had to, like, put inside myself. All I knew is that those little lines sometimes you hear that we think we're never going to cross, I began crossing more and more and more of them. On my the last day of drinking, it was my birthday, my natal birthday, and somebody rented a limousine for me as a gift. And it picked me up. I left at 11, started drinking on one side of town at a fancy restaurant, met some people, traveled around. So by, it was like 2:30, I was still somewhat aware, but I was flying high. And I had the car stop and take me to a rest home where I hadn't been able to get out of a mass. I had to celebrate there. And now we would call it, today it would be called a dementia core, a dementia ward, Alzheimer's. They have lots of different names that now exist. Then there was, it was just the beginning of that whole time of study. But these people were definitely not all the way present. So I went up, he stopped the car, I took off my play shirt and put on the clerical shirt with the collar, walked right upstairs and celebrated Mass. It's a pivotal memory for me because I think, and I always often say that now, and dealing with my own mom who's got vascular dementia, and it's she, thank goodness, it's, she still has most of her memory. But, you know, I've seen people and talked to people, and even though they might have dementia, they know I'm there. They know what I'm saying. They may not be able to respond or articulate what they want as quickly. So it's made me realize that that group of men and women, at least 25 or 30 people, most in their wheelchairs or chairs, they were aware. They could smell the booze on me. They weren't dead. And I celebrated Mass. I had no interest in celebrating that Mass. That may seem wrong, but why would I have an interest? I was partying. I was in the middle of my birthday celebration. So you know what? I'm grateful for those people in my life. I know they've all gone to heaven, and I really believe they were the start of the pack of angels that has protected me. For me, that's how I look at it, you know, because that's a living amends I have to make. Anyway, it went on through the night, parties, whatever. I woke up in the park across the street from the church. A line never going to cross, wake up on the streets outside. Definitely not going to wake up on the streets outside across the street from the church you work at. And definitely, if you have to wake up outside across the street from the church, you're not going to do it at 5:30 in the morning when the doors to the church are opening and the early birds are coming over. So there I am. You understand, get this picture. Rick is here on the curb. I suddenly wake up. There's some homeless people around me. I kind of come to and I realize I'm outside and I can literally go like this. Hey, John. Hi, Martha. I didn't. But I mean, it was horrifying. And what when you know how I felt inside, it was one more line I had crossed. There's so many things I could tell you I did, but it's not important. I just want you to know, when you hear a priest or nun or religious and they're talking about, oh, I did this or I did that, don't be thinking, oh, they probably had a little bit too much rum in their fruitcake. No, we are real wheelers, dealers, stealers, liars, manipulators. We're the real thing. And if you want to come back and get away with a lot, ask to come back in the 80s as a priest. I'm telling you, you're going to have the time of your life if you live through it. Anyway, the point is, that day, I kept one appointment, and the young woman who I'd been meeting with, she was going through a divorce, and she started to talk to me about this thing she was involved with. And at first, I didn't quite get it. She wouldn't say AA, because I had recommended others, people who were really suffering from being drunk, people who were having an impact on their family, who needed it before their wives or husbands got upset. You need to go to AA. All right, I believed in it. I just never put it together with me. So this woman gives me a list of, they used to have it was a yellow card with 20 questions, and she said, don't think about this, just answer them. And so I went through the 21 questions, gave it to her, and then she handed it back to me, and she had put A+ and a happy face on the top of the card. She said, I think you qualify. Anyway, the next thing I knew, I went to my first meeting that night with her. I agreed to it. I was horrified. My thing was shame and scandal. I didn't want to meet anybody. I didn't want anybody to know from the church. So I was in one town. We went to another town in the west side that she knew of this meeting. And there the door opens. And this woman I knew from the parish said, hi, Father Rick. Welcome. I was like, what? And really, I was like, what the fuck? And let's be honest. Like, I just remember, and then I remember doing that sidestep we can do when we're brand new. And I kind of sidestepped to the back of the room. But this woman, Carol, was so charming, and so nice. Didn't ask questions, nothing. She welcomed me. Welcomed me to that room. And I met her again maybe 10 years ago at a gallery opening. And I knew her. I hadn't seen her in 25 years or more. And when I saw her, I knew who it was. And I went up to her and I said, are you Carol? And she was like, yeah. And I went, I'm Father Rick. I used to be Father Rick. And she said, I know. And we talked because it was for a recovery organization. And so we just talked back and forth, and I told her, you changed my life that night by being so welcoming. And we're just my opinion, I think we can underestimate. It doesn't matter what kind of low esteem, high esteem, bad esteem, whatever you have, shy, extrovert, whatever. Our welcomes to people can make a huge difference. It's that just taking a moment and going, hi. And even, you know what? Some people don't even want to acknowledge you. You can just say, hi, my name's Rick. Glad you're here. Have you been here before? There's coffee inside there. Bam. We don't need to get anything back, and it can change a person's life. And every one of you has that possibility to do that in many lives ahead of you. And I'm sure, I know some of you are already doing it because I was welcomed very warmly. So we get to that first meeting. I don't remember anything that happened, but I do remember this. At the end, we stood, gathered hands, and there was this prayer. I thought it was a prayer. It seemed like a prayer or a chant. I couldn't even tell you. But what I knew, because during the meeting, it seemed like blah, 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 laugh, 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 blah, 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 laugh, laugh, laugh. And it was confusing to me, and I was really fuzzy. Because, I would hear, like, snippets, like, I was angry or whatever. I was told off my wife, blah, blah, blah. And then the next thing you'd hear these things, and I'd be kind of inside me going, oh. And then everybody was like, ha, 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 ha. I was like, I didn't get it. At the end, though, I concretely, there were no words needed. It was that language of the heart. My heart felt very profoundly the energy, the real electricity. I knew not this wasn't a religion. I knew everybody was from different walks of life. I could tell from just looking around. And yet at the end, when they gathered and prayed in earnest, there was this authentic, incredible authentic energy. And that's what just phew, snapped right into me. And obviously, you know what? I'd been doing that for weeks and years. And I recognized I led people in prayer. I liked leading in people in prayer. But I didn't necessarily feel it myself. I was happy and grateful that other folks felt it. Wonderful. But here, I felt it. So I was directed very quickly to attend a meeting the following morning. And then what ended up happening was I met other parishioners I knew who, unbeknownst to me, two of them were my drinking buddies, who I didn't know, two gals that I used to like to party with. And another one was another parishioner who had 5 years. I think she had 7 years, which at that time was just like, oh my gosh, 7 years. And then, you know, so she kind of took me under wing, and then she was like, we're going to get you a sponsor, but for right now, you know, just listen to what I recommend. So I started to do the things that were recommended. I started going to a 6:15 in the morning meeting. Remember, I was a guy who was hungover at 6:15. We had 6:30 mass, and way more times than I'd ever want to remember. It was a nightmare. I'd hear, Father Rick, you're late. Father Rick, you're late. That meant the doors hadn't been open. Nothing was ready for mass. There were angry people outside. And by the time I'd get down there in 5 minutes, I was like, what the fuck are you doing here? I hate you. I hate this church. And so that was my experience of the morning. Now, I'd been out drinking, you know, really, let's just be realistic. I was out drinking till like 3 or 4 in the morning when I passed out in my room. I could do my job, but 6:30 mass in the morning and opening up the church, I didn't like that. So, hence, when she brought up this 6:15 meeting, and I'm like, really? 6:15? And, oh yeah, we like to get there a half hour early and help with this. It's like, no. So I started going to this. Changed my life. Why? Because I could get up. And I was there. What kinds of things changed my life? The day I was just standing there next to her, and she'd introduced me to some men, and they were there, they were regulars, and I kind of was like, do you want me to sit down? And she said, no, why don't you go back and talk to Thad, or whatever. And I was like, who's Thad? He's right over there, he comes here regularly, Thad. And I looked, and it was like I looked right through him. I don't see anyone. Thad, he's right there in that seat. You mean the man, the street man who's peed on himself? Yeah, go talk to Thad. Sit next to him. See if he wants some coffee. What the hell is going on? I was like, no friggin' way. Again, how would I know that what I was being done, my heart essentially in a very gentle way was kind of being tugged open. I'm a priest. I am supposed to be of service. And I didn't mind being of service, but really, bringing coffee and sitting next to a man who might have peed on himself? No, I wasn't going to do that. And but that's the things I was asked to do. Clean the ashtrays, clean the cups, whatever. So I began to get the seeds of what humility could be about. I was so arrogant. I don't know if any of you came into the program arrogant, or if you are arrogant and, you know, are just starting. Good for you. You can become fabulous like me also. It's hard. It's very difficult because, you know, for me, my mind was at work. And I thought it was kind. And there was a part of me that was kind, but there was also a piece of me that was could be very arrogant. I just thought I knew too much. And where that began to exhibit itself in those early days of sobriety was, you know, loved to this day, admitted we were alcoholic, was powerless over alcohol, and that my life was unmanageable. Loved that. I studied that because when it began to be explained to me my life was unmanageable, what that meant, was I able to manage all the lies? Was I able to manage where I was stealing? All those things. I felt such a sense of relief. And I was really encouraged along the way. The more you're honest about this, the more you see what you're unmanageable about, you're going to discover help. You're going to be able to get healing. And that's what I did. I did believe that I could be brought to sanity. And I did believe in the idea of a higher power and that I could be brought to sanity. I personally fell in love with the whole idea and notion that I was insane. I love the idea of the jogger walking across the street and getting hit over and over and over again. Or what was that thing, you keep knocking your head against the wall and expecting different results. That was me. So for somebody to be saying, that's insanity, that I myself could claim a form of insanity, made me happy. It helped me to relax. I began, that was me, just the beginnings of me going, I really do have something. There is a disease I have. At least for me, I couldn't all of a sudden say, yes, I have this disease I suffer from. I am an alcoholic. No, but in bits and pieces I did. Third step, stop. No. So, what do you do when you're given permission to believe in a higher power as you understand him? What do you do when, and I began to hear people talking, and that one began to weird me out. You don't have any, this isn't your room, but let go, let God, give it to God, give it. And I'd hear those things and I'd be like, who are they? Why are they saying these things? I didn't like it. And I thought it was very elementary. I thought the stuff that was written in the big book, specifically in regard to spirituality, might be a little too simplistic for me. I had those degrees. I had studied. And look where it had gotten me, into the park. And so the point is that I felt so much shame. I had no problem believing that every one of you, I would give my last breath to convince you that there was a higher power. I had no problem with that. A higher power that was unconditionally loving, forgiving, and that had your back and that could be with you no matter what. That I was convinced of. Did I believe that for myself? No. I had been given the task, the honor, the responsibility of teaching others about God or the higher power. I had absolutely blown it. I had so many times said, no, my partying is more important. And for that reason, and I was really, really grateful that I met some people who helped to cut me down to size at that time. I didn't know that's what they were doing, but they really said, you don't have to know, understand, you don't have to be able to articulate this, there's no test, you're not going to get a degree in this. Listen to how other people speak of their experience with a higher power or God. Listen and see what you can identify with. See what you can learn from. And you know what? That's the path I took. And I'm going to say it took me a good 10 years before I really began to feel a sense of peace inside of myself. It's funny because we talk about, I find myself in circumstances talking about God a lot. And, for quite a while, I wouldn't use the term God. I always tried to be kind of more hip and slick and be like, higher power. And so it seemed more generic, like, oh, no, he's not like. But you know what? Why wouldn't I say God? I would say God because that, I was trained to a certain degree. I probably am not going to say the Triumvirate or the Holy Trinity or whatever. I know. Is that something I was educated in classically? Yes. Did I also get a chance to learn about Eastern religions? Yes. And I find it fascinating. have I also, you know, Native American spirituality. It's not even religions. Some things are about religion, and that's why I like whatever. If you're a Catholic, good. If you're a Hindu, great. If you're Jewish, wonderful. Religions, they help us to maintain order and structure in this world. Behind every religion is a desire for the people within that religion to have a spirituality. That's what we work on. We ask, we hope, and encourage one another to develop our spiritual greatness. And that's what we can do. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I just believe that God is here present in every one of you. Every one of you. And that you are present in God. You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird thing. It gets kind of heady, but you know what? You didn't ask me, but I'll tell you. I'll pretend like you asked me. But yeah, that's how I see my God. Like, yeah. Like, Max is a part of my God. And God is a part of Max. Or Lee. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're all there at one time. I don't believe in the stuff, you know, for me. There's nothing I can do that's going to make the higher power like me anymore. Why? There's nothing I can do. Absolutely nothing. Does that mean I shouldn't be good or kind? No. I should be good and kind the way we learn. We have these principles. We've been given the gift. And we learn about ways of living in this world. They are good just to be good. They are a good, decent way of living. But I don't need to do those to guarantee that God is going to like me. Why? And yeah, I either believe God likes me, loves me, or he doesn't. Or she doesn't. Like the whole he thing, that's another thing. Let's go on about God for a second. Remember Dad? Dad number one left before I was two. And he'd call periodically. He was like a one call every 5 years. And then I didn't see him. Didn't see him for years. But anyway, when we got to this whole father thing, and in the seminary, I could kind of just like, okay, it's part of the Catholic faith, how you explain things. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. All right. And during that time when I was in school, they were beginning to talk about, you know, mother this or that. You could be really radical and find these other expressions. That's fine. Come to AA, and suddenly, breaks on back to, it refers to the Father, and you will find him. You have even those terms, him, him, him. Well, nothing wrong with that. The book was written when it was written. But for Rip, would any of you require that I pretend I know what a father is like? If you do see me after the meeting, because if I have to know what that means to have a father or have a father's love, a father's care, I didn't have it. I'm not whining. I'm really not. That was it. I did not have it. It's not the same when you have a mom or a grandmother or an uncle. I did not have that father's love. I appreciate it so much when I hear sons talking about their fathers or fathers talking about their experience of their children. How else would someone like me learn? How else? But so what's the consequence of that? When I barely began to think of it, I thought, well, I can say the Our Father, you know, together, pray it with everyone else. I can read those words in there. And I don't have to get upset by it. It's all ideas. Do you know what I mean? I hear the word and I just let it go right by me. Maybe, you know, if you said Our Mother who art in heaven, bam, I'd have an image. If you said Our Grandmother who art in heaven, bam, I'd have an image. Our Father, not so much. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with me. We get to start and get to walk our own personal journeys of faith. And that's what I really encourage you in. You get to continue to walk your own personal journeys of faith. Sometimes there's going to be little bumps in the road. For instance, that whole thing I'm telling you about Father. Once I cleared that up, you know, now I kind of laugh at myself. It's no big deal. And, you know, sometimes when I'll hear people, we have, again, I love the 12 steps. We're given, you know, when it says we're happy, joyous, and free, we're given freedom. I get to make choices. I have to accept the consequences of my choices, but I actually get to make choices and say, no, this is how I want to walk this path. This is how I want to believe. You get to do the same thing. Isn't that great? I think it's an incredible gift that we receive. I ended up leaving the priesthood. And, well, actually, I didn't go through the whole rigmarole. I just, you know, technically I'm a long leave of absence. And then I went into, I worked for a man who had a special events firm. The next thing I knew, he moved to Montecito. He said, you're ready to start your own company. I was really creative. And that's my gift. I'm creative. Don't ask me about a car. Don't ask me about just about anything. But creative, I can do it. You know what I mean? And so I went into the field of special events, worked in it for 25 years, never having had a business plan, business experience, all that stuff. And you know, it worked. It worked. And I was here in these rooms. For me, my experience is that we do get the opportunity to practice these principles in all our affairs. And if we don't, those words, practice these principles in all these affairs, you will screw up in all these affairs. And you'll screw up, Rick, over and over and over again until you ask for help. That's been my experience. All I have to do is ask for help or share. And that's why I try my best to be as honest as I can whenever I share at whatever meetings I'm at. Because I've grown from the help that I've received. Had that company, enjoyed great success, did all the bad things you do when you first get money. It was intoxicating. You know, no more the stealing out of that bottom drawer in the file cabinet. You know, I had lots of money that I could spend, and I absolutely was an adolescent with it. I did everything you could do wrong with it. I left, and I suddenly became more celibate than I had been when I was a priest, oddly enough, because I didn't like to go to bars or hook up or any of that kind of stuff. You know, that's another me. There were other activities I did, but anyway, I went along life, and when I was 50, I had a big celebration, and it was after that birthday. I grew very depressed and realized that I just didn't know, was I going to be alone? Was I supposed to be with somebody, be alone? Now, in the course of that time, by a good time I reached 50 years, I had spoken with a lot of people and helped them to feel okay, men and women, just like, okay, you know, some of us are meant to be together, some of us officially, some of us not, some of us, you know, it's just different for everyone. It's just life. And so finally somebody in this program said, have you prayed about it? Huh? Hadn't even thought about that. So I began to really pray about it. Like, okay, God, whatever it is, you're going to have to help me accept this. I need help. I don't know. And honest to goodness, it was probably a couple months later. Raise your hand, David. And I met my partner. And, you know, all the ridiculous adolescent things that can occur when you're 13 years old inside in terms of relationships, that's what occurred. You know, I went to meet him the first time, and we went to Starbucks, and I'm thinking, okay, and it was in a Brentwood, a nice part of the city, and I see him, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And so he ordered whatever. I have an iced tea, water. He's very healthy. And I'm like, and I'm all about like Coke, bad things. And so I'm like, I have a chai iced tea. Well, the thing is, I hate chai and I don't drink iced tea. Why did I order that? Because my first default, here I am. I had a good amount of time, was when in doubt, lie. Absolutely lie. Here's what I want you to think. I look like a man who would order a chai iced tea. Ugh, ugh, ugh. You know what I mean? I did. And then somebody told me, you know, like, well, don't rush into it. David called me right afterwards. He was very genuine. Let's go out. Oh, let me see. I don't think I can. You know, poor thing. I made him wait a while. Finally, I came to my senses. But the point is, how lucky am I? We've been together since. We had a commitment ceremony. We're married legally last year. But here's the thing. If you're in a relationship, hold on. If you're in a relationship with another alcoholic, or it could be a non-alcoholic, hold on. That's where you want to practice these principles in all your affairs. Oh, trust me, you'll get a chance. You will absolutely get a chance. I cannot even tell you. And I mean, it can be itty bitty tiny thing. David, I remember. David, do you want avocado with the salad? I didn't know, mother. Well, it's okay. Well, do you want avocado or not? I don't know. Do you want it? No. Do you want some avocado or not? I don't know. Do you want avocado or not? And this is when I'm on good behavior. Another time, in the happy phase, we'd, you know, been married, putting together a house, and we're at Bed Bath & Beyond. And David was like, good David, gentle David. Well, do you want that for our bedroom? Do you want that for our living room? How about we get those for our kitchen? Okay, the next time, suddenly, I broke out in a loud voice in the middle of Bed Bath & Beyond. Arr, 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 arr! You sound like a fucking seal! Oh my gosh. Like, I couldn't take it. Don't say R one more time. Don't remind me that we're a couple now. Don't you see I'm sensitive? So anyway, you know what I mean? And seriously, those of you who are couples, you understand. Sometimes it's wonderful. And I am so grateful to be in a relationship. And we've gone through some tough times. We've gone through, like, serious times. And, you know, I remember one of the times that was the most difficult and very serious, where I took it to my sponsor. And it was... I can just tell you that it's not that my sponsor has every answer, but at the moment, David was hurt, I was hurt, all I really needed was words of hope and that I could get through it. That's what I got from Max. And eventually, because of this program, I began to realize more and more that, like, what was needed, you know, the typical, oh, stay angry or this or that. No, it was about forgiveness and communicating. You know, and then at the one time that was really difficult, we committed to a year. We said, let's see, keep working at this for a year and see how we feel after that. And you know, I don't want to do it again, but how lucky am I? I could have just blown up in, you know, self-righteous anger or whatever. Walked away, stomping away like a kid having a tantrum. It wasn't easy. And there were times when, trust me, when I would talk to Max, my sponsor, and go, this makes no sense at all. The rest of the world fights it out, and whoever's right, or you raise your hand, you ask people, how many of you think I'm guilty or how many of you think he's guilty? And that's it. So I'm willing to take it to the jury right now. You know, I was. That's not the case with what we do. You know, we learn this other path of forgiveness and acceptance. And it's the same forgiveness and acceptance that I told you earlier. I believe we are all offered by a higher power or higher energy. If you're agnostic or atheist, you know, the sun, the moon, the sky, I don't care. I just know this. You know what? Thank you, Rick, for reminding me. I was looking at that mountainside and those hills, and I thought, I get it. I understand. I know people who are agnostic or atheist. That's fine. But when I looked at the mountains, and some of them are just perfectly chiseled, and sure, scientists would say, well, that was under the ground, and there were, you know, it was underwater, and there were eels that lived there, and they created these caves, and blah, 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 blah. But no, because then, like, how come they rose in this perfect order? Who told that single tree to be on top of that one piece of the hill? How did that happen? And I'm not saying that there's a God necessarily or deity who's going bang, you know, like waving a wand. No, but when you look at the whole thing, I was taken with the overall beauty, and there's an order to it. There really was. I mean, like, my eye kept seeing things. When piece after piece of it looks almost like a painting, it's so perfect in how it's put together. It's like, no, no, no. And I think, you know, I think that's how our lives are. You know, we're right in it. But I think when we step back, there's an order to all of us. Whatever craziness all of you have had this week, whatever craziness you're carrying with you right now, whatever joy you have, whatever passion you are full of, all of it fits together. And that's why I love these meetings. That's why I love AA. And you know what? I think that's enough. And I thank you so much. And I wish you the best on your journey. Thank you. All right.